So I've put up on the board the last item we were talking about at the end. I got a complaint from one person that I wasn't terribly clear about the final conclusion of this point, so let's go over it again. This is the statement of Fatu's lemma. Accept these conditions, and then this inequality holds in general. The limit inside is less than or equal to the limit taken outside. And what's listed below, and this is again, whether it's a Riemann or a Lebesgue integral. In particular, this is a Lebesgue integral because that's what we're going to focus on. But it would work for, well, it's not really defined for Riemann so well. So let's take it a Lebesgue. So I'm going to introduce this function y sub u of x, which is just nothing but a square, has a width u and a height 1 over u, and so the area is unity. And if I let my function of interest here, in place of u, I replace 1 over n, and n is getting big, that means u is getting small. That means I'm indicating that by saying the function is getting very narrow and very tall, kind of having the appearance, there's more room over here, having the appearance of heading toward a delta function. On the other hand, I can take it the other way around, have the function very wide and very short. That's symbolized by this little picture. And here is the conclusion for those two examples, that the limit of the function, first, well, this function is zero everywhere except at a point. So according to Lebesgue integration, that thing integrates to zero. On the other hand, if I take this one here, the limit as this thing goes to infinity, as n goes to infinity, is again zero at every point. So again, both of those are zero, where on the other hand, the area is unity, and the limit of one is one. So that is an example which verifies the inequality. Now, it's really quite interesting that one more ingredient to this lemma brings us to a very important Lebesgue-dominated convergence theorem. I take all of these conditions. So same conditions as Fatu, plus one more, plus the criterion that fn of x is less than some particular function g, which is independent of n, and moreover, g of x, which is clearly positive because all the fn's are non-zero, and this thing is bigger than that, so this is always a positive integrand, that this integral is finite.
Just adding this one extra condition here
will turn this inequality into an equality. And the argument can be made very simple. Let's illustrate that. Because of this inequality, it is true that g of x plus fn of x is greater than zero, or if I make it with a minus, because this thing is always larger than it. So both of those terms are greater than or equal to zero. So that becomes a candidate to use for Fatu. So I will say that for Mr. Fatu, that the limit inside n to infinity of g of x plus minus fn of x dx less than limit outside g of x plus minus fn of x dx. The elementary property of integrals is you break them into two pieces. So this is really, if you like, the limit n to infinity, which will be superfluous here. Less than limit here. Okay, this first term doesn't depend on n, so I can drop the limit. That term is identical to that term. I can subtract it from both sides. So I'm left with a beautiful statement, plus or minus limit fn of x dx is less than limit plus or minus fn of x dx. The plus sign leads to this equation. And the minus sign leads to just the opposite equation. Because when you multiply by 1, the inequality will change its direction. And the only way this can be true, both of them simultaneous, is for equality. Therefore, we have the celebrated dominated convergence theorem, and here's what you mean by dominated. All the functions are dominated by an integrable function. Okay. Very powerful, very useful, and I invite you to convince yourself that there is no G which works in either of the two examples over here. Okay. Now, I took up a lot of space, I'm sorry to say. So the next topic is ...1.3 expressions that masquerade as integrals. For those of you foreign born, masquerade means try to fool us. They are not real integrals. And our first example will be dealing with finitely additive measures. I have the real line. I'm going to integrate between plus and minus L. I have a function inside. I divide by the length of integration 2L. I take the limit of this expression as L goes to infinity. And I'm going to define that expression as an integral with some kind of measure, d tau of x. So this is our finite measure example, the infamous tau function. Put in an f, if the limit works, I get something. Put in the number 1, clearly I get the number 1 out, so that's not so bad. Question is, does this thing define a measure? Does it define a bona fide integral? Well, it satisfies obvious properties. Such as linearity. But it fails on 3 accounts. Now, I present this example because things like this, although this is simple in one variable, things like this often appear when you deal with functional integrals. We have to beware of these subtle guys. So our first counterexample. I make fx greater than or equal to 0. I claim that the integral is then 0. But one of the properties we talked about previously was that this should imply that f of x is 0, almost 0. But the answer is it's false. Here's an example. F of x will e to the minus ax squared a positive. Let's make sure you understand why that fails. I put that function in. It's a Gaussian. The Gaussian is even finite integral when L goes to infinity by itself. So when I divide by that length of integration, that finite value is just going to 0. Here's another case. Let's make a sequence, fn of x equal to e to the minus x squared divided by n. Fatou says, take the limit n to infinity and that should be less than the limit outside. This one is 0. The integral is 0, that's e to the x squared, divided by n d tau of x. That integral is 0, we've just seen that up here. So this side is 0, limit of 0 is 0. On the other hand, as n goes to infinity, this goes to the function 1, and 1 is a perfectly acceptable answer, and I get the number 1. And so that violates the inequality. So this violates Fatou. I can also say that this guy is less than g of x, less than equal to g of x defined as 1. All of these guys have an upper bound by a function which is integrable in this situation. And so this violates Lebesgue as well. Lebesgue said they should have been equal, and of course 0 is not equal to 1. Dominating convergence theory. Item 3. same kind of story. Measures are two measures are countably additive, which means what? Let's have sets SJ which are disjoint, so they equal the empty set when J is different from K. And I take the measure of the union of all those sets, that's equal to the sum of the measure on the individual sets. And that sum can be infinite in extent. That's an important property called countable additivity. Let's look at our example. Our friend Tau here. Our little sets are just going to be little rectangles here on the line. We'll introduce a function, h of x, which is unity, and then in this interval here, and then 0 elsewhere. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to make a sum, h x minus n, n from minus capital N to plus capital N. We'll call that guy h of n. So that's just the sum of these squares repeated next to each other like that. And we can ask ourselves about the limit of this. So we can take, limit hn of x, g tau of x, and relate that to limit outside. Okay, this answer is zero, right, because the hn's have a finite region where they exist, each of them. So the integral is a finite number for arbitrarily large L, and when I divide by 2L, it goes to zero. On the other hand, this guy is unity. That's what that means. I've taken all of the blocks and stretched all the way out to unity, so that's equal to one. Now, this can be regarded as the tau on the set R. That's the tau measure integrated over the whole line, which is unity, and that is not equal to the sum of the tau measure over all of these little squares, which this amounts to. So this is the tau on square n that could be located here. N equal minus infinity, so plus infinity, which is zero. So it fails countable additivity. What do we call such things? What is tau of x? It's not a measure in the normal proper sense of good mathematics. What does it do? It takes a function and maps it into a real number. That's a linear function. Linear functional takes a function and gives you a real number, or a complex number, but our case here could be real. That's much weaker than an integral. These things are called finitely additive measures. Because they fail this important property. And you can see that if they fail that, they fail an awful lot of other stuff too.
Beware of such beasts as you go along.
So is it true that any linear functional can be called finitely additive measure? Or are there some
that's extra? A tricky one. If I take this and say the answer is f of 0, if I evaluate the function by saying it's at the point 0, that's what we did normally would write as a delta function here, I would not call that a finitely additive measure. But that's a linear functional which I would not call finitely additive. Okay, along the way we have asked, for this quantity to be finite, so why is that thing necessary? Well, let's begin by remembering the series. 1 minus a half plus a third minus a quarter plus a fifth, and so on. The answer is natural log of 2, approximately 0.693. But that conceals a great crime. if I separate the positive terms from the negative terms, and I added all these terms up, the positives by themselves, I would get infinity. If I added up all the negative terms by themselves, I get minus infinity. So this is a delicate cancellation between plus infinity and minus infinity, giving us this answer. The answer does not depend only on the numbers involved. It depends on the order of summation. And in my judgment, no good physics represented by an integral should depend on the way the integral is ordered. Now, I want to just prove to you, this is elementary stuff still, gentlemen. But I want to prove to you that I can get any number, any answer I want out of this sum. Anybody want to give me a favorite number they like?
Euler's constant.
How much?
Euler's constant.
Euler's constant. What's that approximately?
0.577.
0.5? Okay. Gamma is 0.577. So what I'm going to do, I'm going to do this by adding up the sequences. What's called that height is gamma. I start with the positive guys, and I take from this set enough numbers to go past this. Well, actually, the first number will take me past it already. Once I'm past it, I dip into the negative numbers and subtract from it until I go below the place I want. If I'm below, then I go back to the positives and I go above. But since I'm taking out the larger numbers all the time, I can get closer to the value. Okay, you understand? Now suppose somebody out here said, oh my God, you misread the telegram, you didn't want gamma, he wanted 10 gamma. No problem. How big is the sum still of all of these terms? Infinity. So I start going up, I start adding all the positive terms until I get past the 10 gamma, and then I go bottom negative. I got the answer. Any number you want. Minus, can be zero, anything you like. The answer does not depend solely on the numbers involved. It depends on the order. You know, in quantum mechanics, you take a trace of a matrix. If I make a unitary transformation of that matrix, then bring the U around, and it's still the same as original. So it doesn't matter. And the unitary transformation means I can interchange the basis vectors, which means I can reorder the sum. So this might have been summation lambda n over here. It's summation lambda some permutation of the n number. So the very same question arises here. Are these things actually equal to each other? Is it true that I can do this? And that's why it's important to limit your traces to operators for which that works. Okay, so when do these things work? When do they don't work? So, definition. If sum a n can equal 1 to infinity, which is defined to be sum n equals 1 to capital N, then limit n to infinity of a n, and b is finite, but summation of the absolute values of these guys is infinity, then the original sum converges conditionally. And the answer, as we've just shown you, depends on the ordering that you have made. If sum an to infinity equals b, and sum an equals 1 to infinity is finite in its absolute values, then the original series converges absolutely and is independent of the order of summation. I'm old enough that I used to use punch cards on the computer. And as I would carry my deck of cards toward the computer, I always had the panic that if I spilled them, I'm really out of business. And one day I did spill them, and they rolled around, and who knows what order they were in. But that's like reordering the sum. Happily, the day before, I had made a backup to that. So it came out okay in my case. So the same things that happen for sums, the same happens for integrals. So f of x dx may converge, but if infinity, then star converges conditionally, depending on how you have made your choice. Now, typically, the choice is fairly obvious. Sine x over x dx from plus to minus infinity. Yes.
If we take that alternating harmonic series,
yes,
and we rewrite it as 1 half plus 1 12th plus 1 30th, etc., you know, by summing the first two terms and writing that as a term, and the second two terms and writing that as
right,
a term,
right,
that's an absolutely convergent
right,
series.
Right. Because you've made a particular order in which to do your resummation.
So is this saying that we can take any absolutely convergent series and write it as a conditionally convergent series if we're clever in our choices?
Sure. Yeah. You can add and subtract infinity along the way.
That's conditionally
convergent. Can we?
What he said was this: if I group these as little pairs, I believe.
Yeah.
That's a positive number, positive number, positive number, and that's why I get the log 2.
And the same thing, if I take any conditionally convergent series, I can rewrite it as an absolutely convergent series?
But you have made a judgment as to how to reorder those terms. If I insist on taking this one and pairing it with minus 1 over 17, and this half and... You know, if I get to play the game of who to order it with, then we're going to get different. I get also an absolutely convergent series, but it will be a different answer.
Okay.
So this is a conditionally convergent integral. You know this by heart. I cannot put absolute values in there and get a finite number. So some delicate cancellation is taking place. Now, it's pretty transparent that this should be a capital L and a minus L here, and I take the limit as L goes to infinity, something like that. That's the natural way, that's the way we teach it in calculus 3, for Christ's sakes, how you do this. It's the Riemann integral, but Mr. Lebesgue would not tolerate that. Mr. Lebesgue insists on his integrals to be called integrals being absolutely convergent. So it is totally independent of the way it's summed. You know about the Cornu spiral, perhaps. e to the I a x squared dx, something like that. That integral is also typically finite. It's involved in the Fresnel integrals, involved in optics. But again, it's conditionally convergent, and I can get any complex number I want out of that by reordering it. Now, the reorderings are rather arbitrary from the point of view of one-dimensional integrals. But when we get to functional integration, infinitely many variables, you'll see the reorderings are not so obscure, not so strange, and that we can get very different answers. Feel free, as we talked previously, to interrupt anytime you like. We had an example on the board the last time we met where dy dx was different from this. And that's because we had violated that. Whenever this is true, then these guys are equal. And it doesn't matter which you order here, because you're adding positive terms. Positive terms, positive terms. And anyway, positive terms will either be finite or infinite. Too bad. That's the way it goes. Okay. So let's go on to chapter 2. The name of our random variable, it can take on discrete possibilities, like a coin or with dice. It can take on continuous values, like if you're measuring the voltage of some noisy circuit. So noisy circuit. Intuitively, if I make enough measurements and I get x1, x2, and x3, x capital N as sample values of this, if that's the head or the tail, or the number 1 through 6 on the dice, etc., or the value of the voltage, then I can get kind of an average value just by summing on those particular values I've got and dividing by the total number. That's an approximate. This may be the definition of that number, but it's only an approximate estimate of the true average. And if I square those things, then I would get the average of the square and so on. Likewise, I can put these things in bins. Let's talk about the dice. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. We will take one die itself. These are the values that n could take. This is the number of times that n has come up. I've done 120 tries or something. So I get a number here like 20, and up here I get 21. Of these, you know, something like that, an approximate histogram illustrating the frequency, approximate frequency of these guys. And so I can rewrite x as, in this case for the dice, xn, the value that it has, n being, no, that's wrong, n being the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and this is the likelihood of that number arising. Okay. Well, it's going to be tough to draw out enough numbers to get an accurate histogram. It's going to be tough to draw out numbers to get an accurate representation when it has a continuous distribution. So we give up on that historically. And we say that the probabilities of the distribution are part of the definition of the random variable. We have to give you the probabilities.
It's 2.2, that's probability. Distributions.
So x will be our random variable. Again, we're going to say that its value is little x, can lie anywhere in the real line, so this will cover all possible applications. And we're going to...
Excuse me, Dr. Clark. Yeah, can you clarify your notation there for your x bar?
The circle?
With your outcomes. And
here?
Everything. Yeah.
Okay. So if I want to know the number, average number of the dice, which will lie between 1 and 6, okay? Then, I got 20 of these, so I have, let's say, total was 20, so that's 20, average was 20. So then I got number 1 times 20, plus 2 times 21, okay? That kind of idea. Okay, so I have to invent, associated with X, I hand you the probability that X is less than some particular number as a function of that number. So this is the probability X values are less than or equal to some number little x. And that's depending on the particular random variable under question. I'm going to call that thing mu of x alone. X being then the parameter that's important, and this is a function on that parameter. And mu of x is a probability distribution. It's also called a probability measure. And our task now is to find, or classify, maybe that's a better word, classify all possible kinds of mu of x. What am I going to classify it with? I don't know very much. You'd be surprised how much I know. Let's look at this definition. What is mu of minus infinity? Tell me somebody.
Zero.
What is mu of plus infinity? Same person? Right. Okay, I know those boundary conditions on this guy. Mu of x and mu of x plus h, where h is positive, how do they stand in relation to each other?
Mu of x plus h is greater than mu of x.
This is greater than or equal to that. Mu of x minus, I'll tell you what that means in a minute, is less than equal to mu of x is equal to mu of x plus. Or x plus or minus is defined as the limit as epsilon goes to zero of x plus or minus. This one is called right continuity. This one is called monotonic increasing. And those three conditions will enable us to classify our functions. So there are three qualitatively different types of mu's. First type is called absolutely continuous. And we'll abbreviate that as AC. And that's defined as the integral of a density, rho of y is greater than or equal to 0. Rho of y is normalized, of course, so that it satisfies this condition. That means plus to minus infinity rho of y is 1. Now, the derivative of AC of x is rho of y. Or I evaluated at that point as rho of x, but almost every, that's what technically it means, almost every. So, trivial as it sounds, mu is the integral of its derivative. And that's the only one of the three for which that's true. Okay, the next one we talk about is discrete, D. And the standard example is, maybe I should plot one of these. There's mu versus x. Okay, that's from that. Standard example here is based on mu discrete of x equal to a function h of x, the Heaviside function, which is 1 for x greater than or equal to 0, and 0 for x less than 0. It is legitimate to say this is the integral of the differential of that. That is legitimate. But it is wrong to say may I make that a Y, okay? This is wrong. Why is it wrong? Because the derivative of this function is 0 except at one point. And one point is a set of measure 0. Mr. Lebesgue says it doesn't count. So this function is not the integral of its derivative. Not the integral. Okay, you guys are modern, you're not from the last century. You realize that this should maybe be written as the integral of a delta function. Has the right properties, 1 way up there, 0 down there. However, while this is a convenient argument,
I'm going to maintain that this is not an integral in the classical sense. Also, I challenge you to evaluate that at zero. Whose value must be coming from the right upper continuous to the unit. Nobody would integrate half a delta function and give me the answer one. So this is not good. Yes, sir.
What is absolute in the absolutely continuous case?
What is absolute about it? Well, because there's going to be the third case is called singular continuous.
Can you integrate that to zero minus?
What does zero minus mean? Well, okay, let's do it. Integrate to zero minus. I would call that zero.
Yeah.
You want to integrate to zero plus?
Zero plus.
Zero plus, okay. Yeah. But why? Who says that? We'll find a better
if it's right zero, is it 1/2?
Should be 1/2, right? You'd like to have it 1/2. Right? That's a very common answer. People use that in physics. Truly. I am sympathetic with you. But that does not give me this. Does not give me the true h. H of x, defined this way, is simply not the integral a of a delta function. And it is also not the integral of its own derivative. Casual about these things, and you're going to say you're going to define that to be unity and things like that. But you don't have to. You don't have to do that. Okay. So this function was continuous. This mu is a continuous function. This mu is certainly not a continuous function. This is a discontinuous function. Plot it, it looks like that. And of course I can make more examples of this kind. Mu d of x could be so let's make all the PLs positive.
Yeah.
Some of the PLs unity. Yes.
Before you continue, I have the last line that you wrote there.
Yes.
In physics is custom to write the delta function as the derivative of the Heaviside function, which is one of the conditions there.
Right.
That is true?
As a function or as a distribution?
As a function.
Certainly not as a function. I ask you, the delta function, how is the function defined? Forgive me. I have great respect for Dirac, and in his first paper where he talked about the Dirac, what we call today the Dirac delta function, he said there is no such function. He's not smart. A function assigns values. Assigns values to each point. You're going to assign infinity, period. Is the square root of a delta function just as good a definition? Because that's also infinity at that point. Or delta squared, just as good, zero everywhere except at that point where it's infinity. But the integral of this and the integral of that and the integral of the other one are quite different. Not a function. Okay, it's a good place to stop. It's time. See you on Monday.